From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Ron Elving on the week in which the government is still shut and Democrats win a round of elections. Then the cost of tariffs. The pre-holiday travel shutdown continues blues. And John Darnielle's new album, With the Mountain Goats, is a musical drama about the crew of a small fishing ship who are stranded on an unwelcoming island.
I used to be a nurse. This is something I believe in. I believe that care is pretty close to the center of the human experience, that we're here to take care of each other. And that's what we ought to do.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, November 8, 2025.
KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Authorities in Lake of the Woods have recovered a boat involved in a fatal drowning last month. The sheriff's office reports in a news release it recovered the 26-foot aluminum flat-bottom jet boat on Wednesday in 24 feet of water in Lake of the Woods. Several divers and Towboat U.S. assisted in the recovery. On October 18th, 69-year-old Brian Harridge of Minnesota and 69-year-old Lori Bringelson of Colorado went into the water when the boat capsized. Both were transported by Lake of the Woods Ambulance Service to Lakewood Health Center in Baudette. Harridge was later pronounced dead, and Bringelson was treated for exposure. The water temperature was 48 degrees at the time. In time with the Minnesota Firearms deer season opener, state and local law enforcement officials have a somber reminder for hunters heading out to their stands and cabins to keep an eye out for signs of missing people. The Beltrami County Sheriff's Office is asking hunters to watch for signs of 68-year-old Russell Coyle, who was last heard from in April when he made arrangements with a friend to watch his dog. He was last known to be at his Kellyer home and generally wears a beard with flannel shirts and blue jeans and always carries a player's holder on his belt. Authorities say to contact them immediately when encountering clothing in an unexpected or remote area where it does not belong and bones or remains that do not appear to be from animals. Assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency is available for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe after this June's windstorm. Two FEMA disaster recovery centers will be open 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. through November 19th. One is at the Leech Lake Facility Center in Cass Lake, and the other is at the former First National Bank building in downtown Bemidji. Leech Lake band members and their descendants are eligible for individual assistance with the impacts of the storm that devastated the Bemidji area and the western portion of the reservation. FEMA offers funds for temporary housing, repairing or replacing owner-occupied homes, hazard mitigation assistance, and other uninsured or underinsured disaster-caused expenses. Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan made a campaign stop in Grand Rapids on Friday. Megan Buffington was there and has more.
Flanagan chatted with some 35 area residents at Brood Awakenings for an hour. The coffee talk was the first stop in a day of campaigning for U.S. Senate in the region. Paula is a speech pathologist in an area school and declined to share her last name. She told Flanagan that teachers can't afford their health insurance plans. At every table, Flanagan says she heard about affordability. It's an issue that helped fuel Democratic victories in Tuesday's election and one she plans to lean into with her campaign. Flanagan will have to convince conservatives and her own party of her plans for universal health care and banning corporate money in elections. Moderate Democratic Congresswoman Angie Craig is also running to fill Senator Tina Smith's seat. Smith announced her retirement in February. How does Flanagan plan to make up the ground that her party has lost in rural northern Minnesota? By just showing up.
Just meeting people where they're at, not expecting folks to always come to us. And that's how I think we rebuild trust with people and how we win elections.
After Grand Rapids, Flanagan was heading up the Iron Range for more conversation, a mine visit, and a food shelf tour.
Northern Minnesota teams saw mixed success in this week's state tourneys. Megan Buffington is back with an update.
Grand Rapids dominated Benilde St. Margaret's in the first round of the 3A football bracket Thursday night. The Thunderhawks won 54-7, led by junior Mason Johnson's four touchdowns in the first half. They'll play Casson Manorville at the bank next Friday. Kitson County Central and Fertile Beltrami emerged victorious in the nine-player Northland matchups. The Bearcats totaled 49 points and shut out Cook County. The Falcons beat Cromwell Wright 40-14. The state title holders will have another rematch Thursday when they play 2024 runner-up Hills Beaver Creek in the semifinals. Immediately after that game, Kitson County Central will take to the field and face Hillcrest Lutheran Academy. Our region's only 2A qualifier, Moose Lake Willow River, ended their season Thursday with a 30-14 loss to Eden Valley Watkins. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The U.S. government's been shut down for 39 days. Yes, it is the longest in U.S. history. Also this week, Democrats won solid victories in the New Jersey and Virginia governor's races, among many others. NPR senior political contributor Ron Elvin joins us from Milwaukee. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
How do you read what you think a lot of voters are saying?
The common message was that they wanted to see more positive change in their own personal circumstances, more focus on prices and jobs and economic futures. And the message was quite clear across state lines and voting groups, not just New York and New Jersey, California and Virginia, but in less noticed races in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and even Mississippi. And yes, blue cities and blue states were voting blue, but voting groups that had been trending for Trump and the Republican Party in those states stopped trending that way. Younger voters, non-college voters, Hispanics, and other people of color. So we have reached the first turning point in Trump's second term. And this is no longer the summer of Trump carrying all before him, testing the limits of his office with no one to oppose him. Voters have now weighed in. The courts are pushing back. There are internal divisions within the Trump coalition, and even some of his supporters in Congress are looking for room to maneuver. So Republicans need to decide how they run and win without Trump on the ballot to bring out his portion of the electorate.
In the end, is it the economy that counts?
We don't have the usual government numbers because of the shutdown, but we have private agencies measuring people losing their jobs, and some of their reports suggest we are nearing recession-level job losses. The University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Gauge, which is a national measure, is nearing a low point. And then there's the new buzzword of the year, affordability. A Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll conducted in late October found that 7 out of 10 Americans say their grocery costs have gone up over the past year, and 6 out of 10 say the same for their utility prices. The president, though, sees things his own way. Here he is talking to reporters about a Walmart Thanksgiving bundle and seeming to equate a certain holiday special with the state of the economy.
Walmart just announced it 2 days ago, 25% cheaper this year, will be cheaper to have Thanksgiving than it was a year ago under sleepy Joe Biden.
What the president doesn't mention is that the Walmart Thanksgiving special has significantly fewer items in it this year. More of them are store brand, not name brand items, meaning they tend to cost less. It's a classic case of shrinkflation, where the product gets smaller.
So after this weekend, the shutdown will be 40 days and 40 nights, the longest in history, getting longer. What are you watching for in the coming days?
It's going to get still worse. People are going to have trouble getting those food stamps because with courts trying to restore full benefits and the administration saying it will comply, even as it appeals that decision to the Supreme Court, all of the confusion will take time to sort out. The air traffic control system was already stretched dangerously thin before this, so we're seeing some airports in chaos, and there have been 8,000 flights canceled. It's hard to imagine the Republicans in Congress making a deal at this point without Trump driving the bargain. And it's hard to imagine getting it done without the House coming back into town in Washington into official session. And right now, Speaker Mike Johnson is still refusing to do that. Mindful, no doubt, that it would mean swearing in a new Democratic member who was elected 6 weeks ago, making it quite likely that the House would vote to release the Jeffrey Epstein files that Johnson has been blocking.
NPR's Ron Elving, very good to talk to you, my friend. Talk to you next week. Take care.
Thank you, Scott.
It's been over 7 months since President Trump enacted those sweeping duties on goods from nearly every country. And one of the questions before the Supreme Court this week, who's paying them? NPR's Juliana Kim joins us. Juliana, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Have we seen retail prices change in the past 7 months?
So far, prices have gone up, you know, for coffee, clothing, furniture, things that are almost exclusively imported. But interestingly, only about 20% of the tariff burden has actually made it to retail prices. That's according to Erica York, an analyst at the Tax Foundation, a group that advocates for simplifying the tax code. She told me companies probably had stockpiles of products before tariffs hit. And also, a lot of businesses held off changing prices while there was some uncertainty around tariff rates. But that strategy is beginning to change, and companies are starting to pass higher costs to the consumer. Economists say that's going to become more common in the months ahead.
What could costs look like in the next year?
So there's some different numbers floating around. The Tax Foundation estimates that if tariffs stay in place throughout next year, a household could face an average burden of $1,600. I also asked this question to Kent Smetters, the faculty director at the Penn Wharton budget model, and he estimates that existing tariffs could tack on as much as 1% to your average spending. So if you spend $50,000 a year, that's an extra $500. Keep in mind, prices are just one part of the story. You know, tariffs can also lead companies to slow hiring or cut wages, which isn't good news for an already weakening job market.
Of course, exit polls from key races this week show that the cost of living and the economy are the biggest concerns for voters. How do you think tariffs have played into that?
Tariffs have pushed prices higher, but for the most part, the increases have been fairly modest. That being said, many Americans are struggling with inflation fatigue. I spoke to Michelle Florio, a paraprofessional in New Jersey, and she says she's held off buying a new car and a mattress because tariffs have made them too expensive, and even her holiday plans are changing.
I have been giving baked goods as gifts for 53 years, and now I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to be able to do. I'll do some. I certainly won't do as much.
This week, she voted for Mikey Sherrill, a Democrat, to be the next governor. Part of it had to do with local issues, but Florio says a big factor was choosing a candidate she felt really cared about the cost of living.
Now, of course, President Trump says that his tariffs will protect U.S. jobs and products and create revenue. Do we see that happening?
So our colleague Scott Horsley reported that the Treasury Department is collecting nearly four times as much tariff revenue as it did a year ago. And that equates to tens of billions of dollars. When it comes to American products, though, York from the Tax Foundation points this out.
When you demand more domestically produced goods, the prices of those goods rise.
She says that's already started to happen with some domestic products.
And then, of course, at the Supreme Court this week, the justices heard arguments over the president's authority to impose broad tariffs, and a decision could come soon. How much of the administration's tariff policy rests on what the court will say?
Yeah, you know, a large share of Trump's tariffs are in question. The Tax Foundation estimates that if the justices decide those tariffs are illegal, a household's annual average burden could drop to $400 instead of the $1,600 figure I mentioned earlier. But even if the Supreme Court rules against the tariffs, York from the Tax Foundation says Trump still has other ways to add more.
NPR's Juliana Kim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bob Trumpy, who died this week at the age of 80, was an all-pro tight end for the Cincinnati Bengals, then took his booming voice and blunt opinions into broadcasting. He had a show called Sports Talk on Cincinnati's WLW Radio. Sports radio can be loud and raucous, blaring with bluster and bellowing. Can you believe that? What were they thinking? But one night in 1983, first person to call in said her name was Sugar. She said she had been drinking and was married to a man who beat her. She said that she hadn't worked for more than a decade and couldn't support her 19-year-old son. And Sugar said she wanted to end her life. I don't know why she called a sports talk show, Bob Trumpy told the Los Angeles Times years later. It was probably just the first number she heard on the radio and decided to call it. And he kept Sugar talking and safe, live on the air for 2.5 hours. It would be a shame for you to check out by yourself when you like people so much, Bob Trumpy told her, according to an Associated Press story about the call. This is a cry for help, and I'm not going to let that go unheard. Sugar's son finally came on the line and revealed where they lived. Emergency workers were able to reach her before she harmed herself. Bob Trumpy received praise for how he handled Sugar's call, but the experience jarred him. I sure didn't feel like a hero after that, he told the Los Angeles Times years later. She wasn't the only one who had to go to a crisis center for therapy. So did I. Bob Trumpy's grandfather had taken his own life when Trumpy was 6 years old. After his conversation with Sugar, he told the Cincinnati Post, I kept seeing my grandfather in his coffin. He would go on to announce NFL games, Super Bowls, and the Olympics for NBC Sports. But the broadcast of Bob Trumpy's life was the night he stayed on the line for hours with a stranger who needed help. He helped save Sugar's life, and in speaking so bluntly about his own struggles, he may have moved others to ask for help, too. And if you or someone that you know is in crisis, please call or text a trained professional. There's help out there. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. And you're listening to NPR News.
18 minutes after 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Weather for today. Partly sunny, highs in the low 30s, winds from the north 5 to 15. Our lows tonight in the mid to upper teens. Partly sunny again tomorrow with highs in the low 30s and blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Monday, partly sunny, highs in the mid 30s. Bemidji community members have a tailgate pantry today, 3 to 5, in the parking lot of the Paul Bunyan Mall. Bring or take shelf-stable food or hygiene items. 10 o'clock this morning, Back Porch Harmony with Dan Lentz. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition.
KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide, working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This weekend, an Israeli military court is weighing the fate of a Florida teenager. Mohammed Ibrahim is a Palestinian-American who was arrested last February for allegedly throwing stones in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. He faces up to 20 years in prison if convicted. He is one of more than 9,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of children, who've been detained in the West Bank since the Gaza War began, according to official Palestinian figures. NPR's Lauren Frayer met his family this week and joins us now. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Please tell us about this case.
So last February, when Mohammed Ibrahim was 15 years old, Israeli soldiers came to his family's house in the West Bank in the middle of the night. This family splits their time between the West Bank and Florida. Soldiers pounded on the door, asked for Mohammed, said he'd been seen throwing stones. They blindfolded and handcuffed him, according to his mother, and took him away. I visited his mother, Muna Ibrahim, who's pretty distraught.
Yes, may no mother go through what I went through. Yeah. We expected, like, he'll come out within 1 week, you know, because he's a U.S. citizen. And we're just keep waiting.
It's been nearly 9 months in Israeli prison. Mohammed is not allowed family visits or phone calls. 27 members of the U.S. Congress have signed a letter calling for his release. U.S. consular officials have been able to visit him. The family says they told them he's suffering from scabies, a skin parasite, and has lost nearly a third of his body weight.
And what's he charged with?
Two counts of stone throwing, and the law says that throwing a stone or object at a person or property carries a 10-year maximum prison sentence. At a moving vehicle, it's 20 years. These penalties also apply to anybody who acts in concert with a stone thrower. And that's what Mohammed is charged with. He and three other teens were all arrested on the same day. I've seen some of the court documents which say that under interrogation, Mohammed admitted to throwing a stone near a road, but says he did not hit anything and didn't try to. I also asked the Israeli military about his case. They refused to comment specifically on his case, but said military juvenile courts in the West Bank are kept secret to, quote, protect the privacy of minors.
20 years for a juvenile accused of throwing a stone sounds pretty severe. Why are the penalties so severe?
Possibly to encourage plea bargains. Most minors in cases like these serve far fewer than the 20-year maximum. But stone throwing hits a particular nerve, Scott, for Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. It was widespread in both Palestinian intifadas. More than 1,000 Israelis were killed altogether in those uprisings, and many times that number of Palestinians as well. Also, this is not the regular Israeli penal code. Mohammed is charged under special security laws that Israel imposed in the West Bank after those Hamas-led attacks of October 7th, 2023. I spoke to an Israeli lawyer, Leah Tzemel. She is not representing Mohammed, but told me how he's likely to be treated under those security laws.
Even a boy, even a younger boy than this one, is considered a security prisoner and will be limited and denied of any right, including food, real food, including family visits. Hardly they can see a lawyer here and there.
And that's in line with what U.S. officials and Mohammed's family say is happening. The Israeli military disputes that, though. In a statement, it told me Mohammed is entitled to a lawyer, all the evidence is made available to the defense, and that there is due process here.
And what's happening this weekend?
Mohammed has another hearing in Israeli military court tomorrow, Sunday. His father, Zahir Ibrahim, told me the past ones have been Kafkaesque.
You know, this will be his probably 10th hearing, you know. And their hearings here is not like America. You wait nine hours, 8 hours, 7 hours. And there's no time when his court starts. And you walk in, and they say next court delayed till next month. That's how it's been 9 months almost now.
He's hoping the court frees him this time, possibly as part of a plea bargain, but it also could announce a conviction, a sentence, or keep postponing.
NPR's Lauren Freer in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
Holiday travel is always subject to bad weather, delays, and illnesses. Add to the mix this year is the ongoing government shutdown, which has already led to flight cancellations. And that's making some anxious holiday travelers reassess their plans, even with Thanksgiving still weeks away. NPR's Liz Baker reports.
Ah, the holiday traveler. Famously well-rested, calm, and polite. Am I right?
Air travel causes anxiety and nervousness among many people on a good day.
Aixa Diaz is a spokesperson for AAA.
Aside from the logistics and the money involved, there are a lot of emotions involved in travel. We travel because we want to spend time with people we love and we want to do fun things.
Especially around the holidays. AAA usually puts out a travel forecast before big days like 4th of July and Thanksgiving. This year, Diaz says that's going to be trickier than usual. More people might suddenly decide to hit the road at the last minute to avoid the airport.
Everything's so fluid, it's hard to chase the headlines with these types of projections.
Headlines like the continuing government shutdown, leading to unpaid air traffic controllers calling out of work, leading to the Federal Aviation Administration's decision to cut flights, potentially by as much as 20%. In other words, anything could happen by Thanksgiving.
Uncertainty is sort of baked into travel, and this certainly doesn't help. But I think keeping it in perspective, controlling what you can, and staying informed, don't be caught off guard.
Traveler Rebecca Abramson says she's staying as informed as she can, following the news and downloading her airline's app so she gets notifications of any changes.
Thanksgiving is actually like one of my favorite holidays to spend with my family, so I'm definitely a little worried about like actually making it there.
The 22-year-old says she hasn't seen her Atlanta-based family for months. She'll do what she can. She's planning to take a half day off work and a ride share to the airport, so she has plenty of time to get through security. Still, she worries that flight delays could cause her to miss Thanksgiving dinner, or worse, work at her new job the following Monday.
It's frustrating that the government can't like figure it out and like just like do what they need to do in order for everyone to not have these anxieties.
Joey Cummings in Brooklyn has been a frequent flyer for decades, both as a passenger and as a recreational pilot. But this holiday government shutdown?
If I'm going anywhere, it's going to be on a train.
And that would be a long ride from New York to Alabama. But for Cummings, it's about solidarity.
I have tremendous regard for air traffic controllers. The average traveler that hasn't had the experience of being on the tarmac, taking off, talking to the tower, has no idea of the degree of responsibility and stress that they go through.
And maybe the best advice of all for coping with holiday travel anxiety, says Cummings.
Be in a place of tremendous gratitude, especially at Thanksgiving.
A little focus on the reason for the season, and, adds AAA spokesperson Aixa Diaz,
chances are your flight's going to be fine. Most people will get to their destinations eventually.
A little dose of perspective before hitting the panic button and the cancel button. Liz Baker, NPR News.
The Department of Homeland Security says agents have arrested more than 3,000 people in Chicago since immigration enforcement actions began there in early September. Immigrants have been changing their routines because of the crackdown and sometimes missing work or school. And as Adora Namagata and Eliha Hertzler McCain of Religion News Service report, some people are also staying home from church.
Three men sit on plastic chairs in a basement in Chicago.
They say mass at their parish feels like home in Guatemala. But now they're too afraid of being detained by ICE if they go to church.
Decidimos quedarnos en casa.
We decided to stay home, go to work and rest. And on Sundays, it's better to stay at home because we have these dreams.
Dreams of making sure his daughter back home gets a good education.
These men agreed to be interviewed as long as we don't give their names because they fear deportation. And we agreed not to name their parish because they worry it could be targeted.
About a year ago, the men were in a severe car accident. One family member died.
When we needed it most, they helped us a lot. And many, many sisters here from this parish came to us to lift our spirits when we were in bed.
The men tell us Mass is the one place they found community since coming to the U.S.
And not feeling safe enough to go weighs heavy.
Se siente muy a pecho, pues.
It hits close to your heart. Well, it feels like, se siente horrible. It feels horrible.
Mm-hmm. After the accident, the parish's migration ministry helped them pay rent and living expenses until they could go back to work as roofers.
The volunteer who helped make that happen doesn't have legal status either. He came to the U.S. from Mexico 28 years ago.
Mucha gente tenemos miedo de asistir a nuestro trabajo.
Many of us are afraid to go to work, to go to a restaurant, to go to church, because everybody is afraid of encountering ICE.
We need to be honest as a country about why people are here and why they do not have documents.
Cardinal Blaise Supich is the Archbishop of Chicago.
It's because we have failed, and our legislators on both sides of the aisle have failed to enact comprehensive immigration reform.
The Department of Homeland Security tells NPR that agents use discretion when enforcing immigration law at houses of worship, and agents need approval from a supervisor before taking action in locations such as churches.
In September, St. Oscar Romero Catholic Parish on Chicago's South Side dedicated its 3-mile Jubilee pilgrimage to praying for migrants. Father Carmelo Mendez says mass attendance there is down about 40%.
We give them the opportunity to come to church, but if they don't feel comfortable, I believe God understands their concerns and their fears.
At the mass after the event, Mendez preached that all people are equally loved by God.
May God Almighty, Jesus the immigrant, Mary of the journey, inspire us to recognize that we are only passing through here. No matter where you were born, no matter when you migrated, our citizenship is not here, but in the presence of the Lord.
At a different parish in one of Chicago's northern suburbs, church attendance is down by about 25%.
The deacon there says the surge of federal agents has made many people scared to go.
We have a group of people bringing the Holy Communion to those people who are in fear for any deportation or any detention.
He's trying to fill in the spiritual gaps by ministering to people online and in their homes. Now, there's a ministry for people to pray the rosary on Zoom, and he brings food to some parishioners several days a week.
The church remains on high alert.
Before they start the masses, people watch outside the parking lot, in the street, if they see any movement or any immigration officer. And before the mass ended, also they do the routine walking in the street to protect our community.
Despite these understandable fears, some immigrants are going to mass anyway.
Back at the Guatemalan Men's Parish in Chicago, we also spoke with a woman whose adult children have been begging her to stay home.
I told them they weren't going to take that away from me.
She also asked that we withhold her name.
She used to attend Mass every day, but now she only goes once or twice a week.
Seeking God is the most important thing for me. They know that because they say that the church is my second home.
This grandmother came to Chicago 38 years ago and serves her parish with care, washing linens used at Mass.
She wants her kids to trust that God will keep their parents safe from deportation.
I tell them that's not going to happen. God is with us. Go to church more. Seek God that you may feel more confident by Him.
She survived cancer and the loss of her home. She says she can't show weakness because she'll make her kids weak.
But sometimes she feels the weight of it all.
I have my children, and I don't see myself separated from them. No, I don't think I could endure that. I've endured a lot that has happened to me because I say my God has given me strength, but they don't have the strength that I have, and maybe not the faith.
God, she says, is her strength. For her, going to church is worth the risk. For NPR News, I'm Aleja Hertzler-McCain.
And I'm Adora Namigadde in Chicago.
And this story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. You know the feel of a good putt? The golf club taps the ball just right. It rolls gently toward the hole at just the right speed, and you can hear the crowd begin, "Oh, no!" The ball clips the rim, spins away. Or worse, it goes into the hole only to roll back out. What is this nasty bit of physics known as the golfer's curse, or the lip out? John Hogan is professor of applied mathematics at the University of Bristol. He's also the co-author of a new article published in Royal Society Open Science and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Do you play golf, by the way?
Not at all.
If I might begin this way, why was this important to you to find out at all?
Okay, so our study is all based in the area of mechanics, which is the motion of bodies under the action of forces. And increasingly, mechanics is used a lot in sport to try and understand phenomena. It's used in Hawkeye and tennis and that stuff. And I got involved initially in a problem related to basketball and then noticed that there were great similarities to the golf problem. Mechanics is kind of like the ugly sister of a lot of mathematics. People said it's all been done and we should be doing quantum mechanics and celestial mechanics. But there's a lot of mileage in the old girl yet, and it's been a fun project.
Now, you've attempted to understand two main, what I'll call, manifestations of the curse, the rim lip out and the hole lip out. Can you talk us through that?
Sure. When a golfer puts a ball, it rolls along the green. But when it encounters the hole rim and starts to roll along it, you get another rotation induced as the ball starts to pitch into the hole. So you have these two rotations which are going on. And basically, the fate of the ball is decided by a competition between these two rotations. Now, when they exactly balance, the ball rolls around the rim at a fixed speed and it leans into the hole at a fixed angle. And this is what we call the golf balls of death.
Good Lord, that's a dramatic term.
And then if the rolling dominates the pitching, the ball can still go a little bit round the rim of the hole, but then it flies off onto the putting green.
Yeah.
And that is the rim lip out. But if pitching into the hole dominates, then either you have a successful putt, or you can have this very nasty thing called a hole lip out, where the ball is rolling along the inside of the hole now, and its potential energy, because it's high above the bottom of the hole, is converted into spin, and it has a sort of pendulum motion, and it comes back out again. It's a bit like a skateboarder when they drop into a half pipe or something. They come back out the other side.
Forgive me. All I do is play putt-putt golf with our daughter sometimes. Is this going to help me?
I would say that, certainly my golfing friends tell me, this sort of thing happens when you hit the ball too hard. So the first thing I'd say is, don't hit the ball too hard. The second thing I'd say is, you know, a golf hole, it has to be 4 1/4 inches wide. That's the standard width of all golf holes. None of these problems happen in the middle. So if you go there slowly and you get close to the center of the hole, you'll be fine.
Well, that sounds easy.
Much easier said than done. I'm in awe of golfers, how they imagine to get anywhere near the hole.
With respect, was this a problem that needed a solution?
I'm retired. I'm emeritus. It's a completely curiosity-driven thing. Having said that, you know, in the US, golf has got an economic activity rated to be about $100 billion a year. And given that 40% of golfing shots are putts, more people could join in and get involved. Personally, I was driven from a curiosity perspective.
John Hogan, his new research article is called, what a title, Mechanics of the Golf Lip Out. Practically trips off your tongue, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
This is NPR News.
It's Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. It is 7:39. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. More information at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Kutaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office. Located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids, they also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2 Monday through Thursday. Headwaters Music and Arts hosts Annie Humphrey tonight as a benefit for Voyageurs Expeditionary School. Doors open at 6 with an art-making opportunity and a soup meal. Annie Humphrey will be joined by musicians Corey Medina and Lakota John beginning at 7. Find more info and purchase tickets at headwatersmusicandarts.org. Let us know what's happening in your community. Email us, psa@kaxe.org. More news is next.
Bill Snyder with these headlines. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban says President Trump has agreed to exempt Hungary from U.S. sanctions on Russian energy. The move keeps Russian oil and gas flowing into the country. Orban and Trump are political allies. They met at the White House yesterday. Pakistan says peace talks with Afghanistan are deadlocked. The talks are aimed at preventing border clashes. Despite the breakdown, a Taliban spokesman said today that the ceasefire remains in place. And another typhoon has the Philippines in its sights. The storm is forecast to make landfall by early Monday. A typhoon earlier this week killed more than 200 people in the Philippines and five in Vietnam, where hundreds of thousands have been displaced. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Legacy Box, dedicated to helping customers turn boxes with family videos and photos into memories that can be shared with generations to come. More at legacybox.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Montana is filled with natural wonders and famous tourist attractions, Yellowstone, Glacier National Parks. Not, however, B.J. Lederman, who writes our theme music. Lately, a new kind of wildlife tourism is also becoming popular, bat tours. Biologists are taking people out to see the creatures whose survival is in jeopardy. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kayla DeRoche has more.
On an August weeknight, Melanie Hall finally got tickets to something she's been trying to join for a while now. So she brought her daughter's whole basketball team, the Helena Shooting Stars.
Yeah. This is the crew.
Hi. It's really just very cool to be out on the lake at Gates of the Mountains in the evening, watching the sun go down. It's very Montana.
Gates of the Mountains is in a canyon of steep, craggy cliffs on either side of the Missouri River.
I'm glad to be able to share it with, a bunch of 11-year-olds.
During the day, thousands of bats sleep in the cliffs, waiting for sunset to swoop down into the river valley for a meal. Boat tours like this one are a rare opportunity to see bats up close and personal.
First of all, this is a magical spot for bats.
Shannon Hilty, Montana state bat biologist, is one of the leaders of this tour.
It's just a bird. Don't get excited.
Montana's bat experts say they've been holding observation activities for roughly a decade, but have seen public demand surge over the last 5 years in response to an increased focus on conservation in policy and media.
Oh, look at this guy right here.
This sunset boat ride on the Missouri is one of the most popular tours biologists lead statewide in the summer. As the first few gray bodies skim the surface of the water, handheld devices most passengers were given amplify the animals' ultrasonic chirps. As more bats glide down, passengers gather at the back of the boat, watching them flit in and out of its bright lights.
You need to get closer, don't be scared.
Hi, robot.
12-year-old Serena Light is here with her mom and sisters. She homeschools and is especially interested in bats.
I don't know if I've been on a boat, and I don't know if I like it, but I honestly think bats are pretty cool.
That's why 11-year-old Mary Grace Hall is here, too.
I really just think their wings are so interesting because they use their wings as their hand. They actually have five bones in their wings that work as their fingers. And I think they're just really interesting animals.
State wildlife managers are encouraging this growing interest to raise awareness about bats and their vulnerability to threats like disease. They say they save the agricultural industry millions of dollars a year by controlling bug populations.
And to know they eat grasshoppers and stuff is great because I have a lot of those. So.
Chad Brown is on a walking bat tour at the Billings Zoo. Tickets for this one were hard to get also. Brown says he thought bats just carried rabies and he grew up afraid of them. But he's not anymore.
We're going to try and build one of these bat houses, I think, and promote keeping them around.
Montana's bat experts are planning more bat observation activities and educational opportunities statewide. They say they're excited about the growing popularity of these tours as a tool to spread awareness about the nocturnal animals and their conservation. For NPR News, I'm Kayla DeRoche in Billings, Montana.
Retailers across the country report problems at their registers. They can't make exact change because the U.S. has stopped minting pennies. The coin costs almost four times to produce than its one-cent value, so what can retailers do? An expert says tell customers they're rounding up or down the nearest nickel.
They'll feel hurt sometimes. Dang it, I lost 2 cents. But if they pay attention and they're an average person, it'll break even over time.
A penniless future Sunday on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha. You can listen by tuning into your local member station or tell your smart speaker to play NPR. On the day of her 18th birthday, a girl named Noelle comes home from school and finds a letter waiting for her. She recognizes the handwriting immediately. It's from her mother, who had walked out of Noelle's life a decade before. In it, Noelle finds the answer to a question she's never stopped asking. Where did her mother go and why? This is the premise of Chiara Alegria Huda's debut novel, The White Hot. Huda's is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who was behind works like In the Heights and Water by the Spoonful. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento recently caught up with her in New York City.
It's a crisp fall morning in Washington Heights when I meet Chiara Alegria Hudes at a tall brick building near the Hudson River.
This is my writing studio. It's one floor above where I live.
There's a couch, a piano, and a giant pinboard where Hudes spent years organizing notes for The White Hot. The idea for the novel came to her over a decade ago while she was listening to Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill.
The thing about that album is she's this young woman. She's got all this anger. She's got all this rage.
And all I really want is some patience. A way to calm the angry life.
But she's also playful, and she's also curious and smart and spiritual, and I loved that kind of mess of big emotions that she had.
This was the inspiration for April Soto, the missing mother and anti-hero of The White Hot. At 26, April lives with her mother, grandmother, and Noelle, who is the result of a high school pregnancy. April's barely holding it together. One day, the Soto women are sitting down to dinner, and an argument breaks out. Plates get smashed. Over the yelling, April's abuela tries to sweep up the globs of rice and beans that have fallen on the ground. It triggers something in April.
She has this vision, oh my God, the women in this family have been sweeping their truths, their traumas, their sorrows, their brilliance under the rug for generations. This broom becomes this kind of gateway into, I've got to break this cycle.
April leaves. She walks out on her mother, on her grandmother, and on Noelle. Here's Hudes reading from the letter April leaves for her daughter.
My anger had launched a voyage, and voyages were my birthright. There is a legacy of departure and seeking, Noelle, that is your inheritance too. Despite all the domestic play acting, you are born of journey women. Know this, remember this, when you step towards places you're not meant to go.
April wanders, searching for meaning. While communing with nature, she's reminded of Siddhartha, the Hermann Hesse novel about a man's quest for self-discovery. Like April, Hudi says she was fascinated by that book when she first read it. But she was also struck by the notion that it's a man who has the freedom to leave responsibility behind for the sake of an inner journey.
My mom was a very spiritual woman, but she had to find God, honestly, while doing the dishes, okay? Like, I wish my abuela could just take off and be free of all the caretaking she does.
So Hudes gave April Soto that freedom. On her search, she finds caves, waterfalls, and jazz.
She hears the rage in Charles Mingus's bass playing. She hears this kind of electric life force.
She wishes she'd had the chance earlier to channel her own energy, what she calls the white hot, to figure out who she really is.
She's been a woman in service of others her whole life. And now she's something different. She has to be in service of herself because she has to stay alive. And she's really never served herself in her life.
April chooses herself over her responsibility to her daughter.
It puts the reader in the position of, can I forgive mom? Here she is explaining, telling me about this amazing spiritual quest, this amazing adventure she had at the cost of me.
For Kiara Alegría Hudis, that's the big question. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News, New York.
A fishing ship is wrecked, leaving only the captain and a few crew members on a small island not fit for survival. They begin to starve and to hallucinate.
Still as the sky on the ocean, mute as the moon overhead, me and Peter Balkan and you, friend, everybody else is dead.
Through This Fire, across from Peter Balkan, is the new album from the Mountain Goats, and the group's frontman, John Darnielle, joins us now from Durham, North Carolina. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
The idea came to you in a dream?
It did. I have a little note app that I use to write down dreams in as soon as I wake up, because I've been told all my life you're supposed to do that. But often I go back to sleep, you know, if you wake up too early, and I wake up a few times, and I looked in my note app one morning, and I had had this dream that I was working on an album. There was no visual component to the dream. It was like a dreaming about being a farmer or something without seeing farming implements, just dreaming of being in a certain state of being. And the dream I had was I was working on an album, and that was its title. And I had written it down in the app, so I wrote it down on a piece of paper.
How did you get from the title to the album?
So the thing is, I then had to make sense of the title, right? Because your subconscious mind isn't concerned with your demand for rationality, right? And so, yeah. So the title was Through This Fire Across from Peter Balkan, right? I don't know a person named Peter Balkan. The whole album kind of explores trying to explain the title, right? Trying to sort of give it a narrative shape.
There wasn't any fire and brimstone left, just a hollow rattle inside your chest. Deep in the dark of our 45th day, it wasn't ever gonna go away. I began to understand the things the heat requires.
And I learned this from people actually at Second City in Chicago, how to flesh out an idea that's only got a couple of words or a sentence. Well, through this fire, okay, well, then there must be across from Peter Balkan, then there has to be a person speaking who's looking at Peter Balkan, so there's two people, right? They're on either side of a fire. Where do we speak on either side of a fire? Either when we're camping or maybe on the beach, right? So I started filling in images, asking a lot of what-then questions, right? And that's how I got to it.
And how did you ever get Lin-Manuel Miranda as a backup vocalist?
Well, we're friends. We exchange thoughts sometimes, and we're similar people in that we get very excited when we're working, and so I send him stuff, and he's kind enough to listen to it and let me know if he feels like I'm in a good space. And so and he had heard a lot of these, right? I'd be sending them along, and the morning I wrote Armies of the Lord, I was very proud of it. I sent to him, and he, you know, said it was good. And so when it came time to record, I thought we're going to be in New York, and I'll ask if you want to come up and sing. And he did.
Raise the flag and cut the cord. All aboard, that's going aboard. All aboard, all aboard.
You're also a novelist. What makes this into an album and not a novel, or at least for the moment a stage play?
Well, the dream. The dream was that I was writing an album, and that was its name.
Boy, you really are trying to remain loyal to this dream, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. No, that was it. It was capricious. It wasn't like I didn't say, well, then by God, I'm going to do this. It was just a sort of a lark on a day. It's like, I said, well, what if you actually did that? But I wrote Fishing Boat and I wrote Cold at Night. I was just starting to think about the things, right? And then I wrote the first song and it was pretty good. So I wrote another one. But it was at the time, I almost never set out on anything thinking, oh, this is going to be the next big thing. I just sort of tinker. And then when something starts to take shape, then I want to be true to the first principles as long as I can.
Well, the first thing you learn is how strong you can be if you have to. And the next thing you learn is how cold it can get at night.
I think it's fair to say you're known for writing music that comes from some of your own troubled times.
The thing is, I think I'm known for that because of one particular album. But for the most part, there's two albums that do that, and the rest is mainly storytelling. But yeah, but the album for which I will be best remembered is absolutely about my adolescence.
Yeah, which wasn't easy. Is that a fair way to put it?
I worked with a lot of kids later who had it much worse than I did. So I don't want to, you know. I mean, I lived with parental abuse. But you know, I wasn't hungry, so that's, you know, I think that's an important distinction. The fact is that I'm here and I'm 58, right? And so all that stuff, you know, it's a terrible cliche to say that what didn't kill you made you stronger, but I've managed to make good stories from the stuff that I learned to live through, you know? And to me, like, would I trade those experiences? I don't think that I would. I am who I am and I'm happy with who I am, and that's part of my story. So yeah, so it's complex, I think.
I will turn these stones to bread, and all who hunger will be fed. Plates will shift, and the earth will groan, and no one here is gonna die alone.
You have dedicated this album to Peter Hughes.
Yes.
Who played bass for the Mountain Goats for nearly 30 years. I guess the first album since he left the band last year.
That's right, yeah.
Did his exit play any kind of role in the story, do you think?
No, he was still in the band when I was writing the album. He had all the demos, so he was going to be on it. And then his time came to leave. And I mean, we love Peter. Peter's a brother to me. The thing is, so when he left, is like the first thing I thought was like, well, wow, thanks for 30 years of being in the band. And the second thing I thought is, do I have to change Peter Balkin's name? But I said to myself, no, that would be a cheap thing to do.
It's time for you to go, but you never lost your glow.
I mean, it's a story of friendship and of following people's visions, right? Like Peter Balkin loses his mind and starts to imagine the apocalypse, right? And his friends go along with him. And I think there's something in that about the nature of friendship. If we're stuck in a situation with one another, we want to cleave to one another's visions, even if they go wildly astray. But it winds up being a story about care, right? It winds up being a story about caring for one another. I used to be a nurse. This is something I believe in. I believe that care is pretty close to the center of the human experience, that like we're here to take care of each other, and that's what we ought to do. And these are people in a situation where they have to, and that's what draws me into the story.
John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats, and their new record is Through This Fire, Across from Peter Balkin. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunities for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is coming up on 8 o'clock. Good morning. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report, local news from our region, in just a few moments. 9 o'clock this morning, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's stories and songs about dancing. And 10 o'clock, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. Weather for today, partly sunny, highs in the low to mid 30s, north winds 5 to 15. Our lows tonight into the mid to upper teens, and for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs again in the low 30s with blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Monday, partly sunny, highs in the mid 30s.